Well, on 8th June 1981. But the actual meeting at Jodrell Bank in 1955, do you remember any important results from that or any impressions that you have?
Well, of course, these early meetings were important because you met up with other radio astronomers. And at that time, I'm afraid I must say that there weren't very many American ones.
Yes, that's right.
But you met up with the Dutch and the French, mm-hmm. who was the most energetic. And that was also true, of course, at the Paris meeting. And you saw the Meldon approach to a large instrument, which is interesting. And, well, I knew Van der Holst anyway, but, you know, you met all these people. And that was the main importance to me of it.
I see.
You met the guys that you often corresponded with, and you saw the way they worked, and that was important too. Astronomically, I can't really recall anything very special. I think the Jodrell meeting, maybe the Paris one too, may have been somewhat confused.
Meetings were somewhat confused.
Confused with really unnecessary controversies about log-s's and things, which you know, it took up too much of everybody's effort. Whereas, I mean, it was important, clearly, but I felt there was a certain amount of trying to prove the other guy was wrong about
mm-hmm.
it,
yeah.
Which was sad because, I mean, in fact, I mean, well, I mean, some people are always more difficult than other people are, and you can cooperate with some people much easier than others. I felt that, well, never mind.
Well, what you're saying is that people began to lose sight of really finding out what the universe
yep.
was doing and just backing their own...
That's right.
Their own results. Well, science is a human activity, to say the least. It's pretty,
yes, but
pretty
I
hard
think
to
it
avoid.
Began to... It began to the important parts of all these conferences, when you got so-and-so into a corner over coffee and talked to him,
yes.
that's what mattered.
Right.
And that's what happened the first time at the Rome meeting with Bader and Minkowski.
Right.
The rest of it, I have no recollection useful at all.
Okay.
You went to meetings and people got up and said, I just happened to have 23 slides in my pocket, which I thought I'd show you. And they were absolutely irrelevant and you know, you felt
right.
a bloody waste of time. But the meeting with individuals and talking about something that you
mm-hmm.
were both directly
mm-hmm.
yeah. vitally concerned with, those were important.
Right.
And
well,
I think that remains true today.
Well, now, in fact, I mean, I'd be very interested to know, I mean, did you sit down with Mills and
yes.
in the corner
yes.
and try to hash this through?
Yes.
But apparently it didn't.
No.
You weren't able to get anywhere, or were they
no.
useful?
No, I mean, well, it got as far as saying, well, we've obviously got to do something more about this. It's got to be solved. And we both went back and, well, ultimately it was solved. But it was the personal meetings which I recall
mm-hmm. Yes.
as being the things that mattered.
Do you remember other people that particularly impressed you with what you were learning from them at these personal contacts?
Well, Van der Holst was the outstanding Dutchman. The French, yes, there was that. Desert, sort of foreign eating chap. Desert too long. What was his name?
Denise.
Denise, yes, Jean François.
Right.
He is a great guy, and so also was.
Steinberg,
who had spent the war in Auschwitz or somewhere and got away with it. He'd married an English wife, and they were very kind to us. But they were the two leading lights at that stage,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they were nice, calm, easy chaps to get on with.
Did you feel that the French contribution to solar radio astronomy in the 10 years after the war really ever amounted to anything?
I don't quite know what went wrong or didn't go quite right with the French, because basically they started off very well. I think possibly it was the fact that they were too closely tied on to Meudon Observatory, which was, you know, basically an Arctic observatory.
Right.
Oh, they had this mad
Lafleniere.
Picard. Well, no, Lafleniere was all right. I think he was perhaps not all that brilliant, but he had good ideas, and he did a lot of work, optical work. And they had this mad Picard, son of other Picard, who did high altitude balloon work, and that was the most dicey thing I'd ever seen. Terrifying. 58 Met balloons in a string, so it didn't matter if a few burst.
Was this radio astronomy?
No, he was mainly concerned with flocculi, whatever they're called.
Right.
Which you had to get above. He went up to, I don't know, 120,000 feet or something in this thing. And there was a little aluminium sphere which he'd built himself. He's a long, tall, thin chap, and he could just curl around like that and get inside it. And the lid wasn't fixed on. He just held it up while the thing took off. And after a minute, because of the air pressure, held it there. And as you came down, just before you got to the ground, it fell off and bonked you on the head to remind you to get ready for landing. He's a mad guy, but he survived. He survived several flights for that thing.
But why were you saying that? Why were you saying that the French didn't seem to?
Well, I think they probably didn't give enough, basically enough cash to radio astronomy to make it viable early enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did build this big parabolic wall eventually,
right?
Which was a new, an interesting concept for building big instruments. It
that was 56 or so, but
yes,
when they got to that
about then.
Okay, the final thing that I wanted to ask you about was, we did discuss at length how the ideas of synthesis developed last time, but I'm still a little unclear in my mind about how difficult it was to measure phase in the late 40s, early 50s. In other words, if you'd had...
It's entirely how far you were going.
Okay, but if you'd had the computer at some early date... then when could you have done astrosynthesis with what baseline at what frequency? Can you give me some idea of that?
Well, John Blythe was the first. When was that? We did it.
Well, that was 56 or so. But
no, it wasn't.
It was published in 57, I'm quite sure.
Was it?
Yeah. Maybe I should rephrase the question. Can you give me an idea for specific examples... how well you could measure phase at a certain frequency with a certain baseline in the late 40s, let's say, and then the early 50s.
Well, it was no different.
It was not different. What were the limiting factors?
Well, signal to noise. I mean, attenuation of the cable. Just that the reflected wave coming back got so weak you couldn't measure the minimum, actually. If you had two cables, it was different. You could do round-trip things and play about arrangements. But we didn't have enough cable.
I see.
But, I mean, there was no problem in the John Blythe experiment. I mean, that could have been done in 1946. It was the same apparatus we used, which was a brass standing wave detector about a feet long, because it was a long wavelength. It was not a nice design, actually, proudly. But it was, in fact, based on a German one I pinched for a shortwave work. It was a little one about this long. It's a method of locating the probe accurately along it as it moved along.
What exactly was it now?
It was a standing wave detector.
A standing wave detector, okay, right.
Which you have everything 8 feet long, and you've got to align the probe so that it stays accurate.
Yes.
And at about a 50th of a millimetre all the way, you had to do something rather special.
Right. So that's interesting. So if the concept had been there, you say that you could have done the Blythe moving T experiment right at the end of the war, technically.
Well, apart from the computing.
Yes. Right. And you could have done the computing if you'd been willing to spend a hell of a lot of time with a lot of people with pencil and paper, presumably. But
well, you've got these lips and beaver strips, which is the quickest way of doing it.
Right. So that, in fact, is it correct to say then that the ability to measure phase was not any kind of a limitation on doing astrosynthesis?
Well, no, I mean, phase measurement was an established fact of life, which one had done during the war. I mean, that was why I had to do this.
It only became a problem when you started going to the higher frequencies.
It was just a function of the attenuation of the cable. So the relationship between frequency and,
right,
and distance.
Right. And even with these good quality German cables you had, this became a problem. Well, what was the actual attenuation? Can you give me a rough idea of how much? At a given frequency?
No. If you look up the best cable of that sort of size, which somebody rather makes, it'll be about the same as that.
Today, you mean?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It was as good as any cable has ever been made.
I see.
It was 98% velocity of propagation. It was very little.
Hmm.
Well, it wasn't polythene, it was polystyrene, the Germans used. It was a very nice design.
Hmm. So that really then it was just a matter of when you had the computing power and the idea, of course, available, that you could then do the moving T and you could do the experiment with Ann Neville later on in two
to
dimensions,
the North Pole. Mm.
Right, and so forth. Mm. It was really that was the limiting factor. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I mean, there was, of course, mechanics and money involved in moving, say, a couple of large Würzburgs
mm-hmm.
along a railway track, because you've got to make a railway track, and that costs money.
Right.
And it's got to be, unless you're going to survey each position as you go, it's got to be a good, it's got to be stable anyway, even if it's not straight. So, I mean, it was an expensive game, but that could well have been our next instrument, instead of the 4C aerial,
mm-hmm.
As indeed it was discussed, rather than the 4C aerial, if the computing had been there.
Mm-hmm.
But the computing in the general case was very much worse than the computing in the North Pole case, which itself was very much worse than the one-dimensional 4C synthesis.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much again. And that ends the follow-up interview with Martin Ryle in Cambridge at his office in the Cavendish Lab on 8th June 1981.